Shalom, everybody. Welcome back to part four of the series, Your Wife by Covenant. This is going to be the final part of the series that we'll be talking about the male and female relationships in their proper cultural and contextual context. But I do plan on coming back and revisiting this series in the near future. And we're going to take all of this great stuff that we've been learning about God's intentions and God's plans for our marriages. And now we're going to take that and we're going to apply that to the marriage, metaphorical marriage between Yahweh and his bride, Yisrael. So look forward to that in the near future. But today what we're going to be talking about is we're going to look into the culture and the customs surrounding the first century. And there's actually two different cultures that we need to look at. The first one is the culture in Judea. In Judea, the overwhelming thought processes were through rabbinical interpretations of the Torah. And so we're going to have to look into what the rabbis had decreed as far as marriage and divorce and remarriage was concerned. And then with that understanding, then we're going to take that into the realm and see what Yeshua was actually talking about in Matthew 19 and in Matthew 5. And this is really kind of the culmination of everything. This was why I started this series, was to address one single question. Is remarriage after divorce valid? Right? Because there's a lot of people who come into the Hebrew Roots movement after being in the world, being in the church, and they've been divorced, and now, you know, they're single, and what do? You know, you look at the words of Yeshua, and without proper understanding, we're going to come to the idea that there's no valid reason for divorce, which is what the Catholic Church has come up with and has caused a lot of strife through the ages because of their position. And then there's the other problem. What happens, you're divorced, and now you come to Torah, and you're trying to keep all these commandments, but it looks like Yeshua is saying that if you ever remarry before your husband or wife dies, that you're committing adultery. We're going to look into that and see exactly what Yeshua was saying about that. And it's going to be very, very interesting, I believe. So the other thing that we're going to be talking about is the words of Paul. Now, Paul, you know, sometimes he seems to conflict with Yeshua. And what I want to show you guys is that there was actually two separate cultures that were being addressed there, right? Yeshua was speaking to the people who lived in Judea, who lived in what was called Judaism at the time. And so they had a very unique culture that was different from the surrounding cultures. Paul, on the other hand, he was dealing with people who were now coming into the faith after living in the Greco-Roman world and having to live in their Greco-Roman culture. And there was a lot of differences there because they were living under a different set of rules for marriage and divorce. And so these people coming in, a lot of them, you know, either they were already married, they were already divorced. You know, sometimes their spouse, now that they come into this, now their spouse doesn't have anything to do with them. So what do we, what is Paul actually saying here? And that's actually going to be very applicable for us today, because a lot of us come into the Hebrew Roots movement and, you know, there's just the other spouse doesn't want to have anything to do with it. So what do you do? And that's what we're going to be looking into today. All right, so we're going to talk first about the changes in the Judean culture from that of the ancient Near East. And once again, I want to point out the book that I'm mainly using as a stepping stone for all my research is this book called Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible. It's by David N. Stone Brewer. I highly recommend getting it. It is very well referenced, and it's allowed me to, you know, read it. And then as I see the references, then I can go to that reference material and read that as well. So it's really helped me out quite a bit here. So what was changing in the Judean culture in those days? Now, first off, the marriage age had changed. Adult women were now much more free to make their own choices, right? So if a daughter had not been married off, by the time she reaches adulthood, now she's basically free to kind of make her own choices. Now, the fathers obviously still wanted to have control of this because, as any father would know, we often would prefer to choose the husband of our daughters ourselves because, let's face it, they're immature and they don't always make the best choices. And so most fathers out there probably are going to want to make those choices for their daughter and pick someone who's actually going to love and support, not just lust after their daughter. So oftentimes they would actually betroth their daughter at a much earlier age so that they would guarantee their right to be able to actually choose the husband for them. The Levirate marriage institution, remember, the Levirate marriage institution is when a woman dies and she's childless, now it's up to the duty of her husband's brother, who's living with them, to raise up a child for them in his name. Well, this institution, while it was still spoken of, and we'll actually see it a little bit later on, it really wasn't practiced much at the time. And so mainly what would happen is if a husband would die, they would basically all get together and they would go out and do the removing of the shoe ceremony and spitting on the face. That was what they did in order to quickly get rid of that burden, and then the woman was free and she would go and marry whom she pleased. Now, when they returned from Babylon, there was, you can read in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, right? They were very poor. They did not own the land anymore. They were actually a vassal kingdom to various suzerain kingdoms. And at the time in the first century, we know it was Rome. And so, being a much poorer nation, it was harder to practice these customs. Remember, we talked about the bride price, which was that the money that the prospective husband would pay to the father of the bride to basically show him that he could provide for his daughter. Well, because they did not have as much wealth, they got out of the practice of paying this. And so what the prospective groom would do is that he would sign a legal contract promising this bride price to the father, so that if anything ever happened, between him and the wife, right now he would be obligated by the courts to pay this set fee. But at the beginning of the marriage, he didn't actually have to save up, and he didn't have to earn it. He didn't have to pay it out. Now, on the flip side of that, now the dowries actually increased because with the way the culture was, they really didn't want to have to provide for their daughter, should something happen to the husband or should he divorce her or whatever. So they would actually increase the size of the dowry, and that would be given to the family, and it would be in control of the husband, as we'll see a little bit here later on. And so these two factors coupled together actually led to an increase in divorced women staying single, because now, after the divorce occurs and she gets her dowry, right? Now she's actually pretty well off and she's able to be self-sufficient in that day and time. And so a lot of women simply chose to remain single at that point in time. So they could enjoy a little bit more freedom, because we're going to talk about this later on here, but the women really were married women were very restricted in what they could do. They had to wear certain clothing. They had to abstain from talking to men in public, essentially. And remember, this is not scriptural stuff. This is the culture at the time. This is what the rabbis had decreed through the oral Torah. And we know that Yeshua spoke out pretty harshly against a lot of the things in the oral Torah. He talked about the Pharisees binding heavy burdens upon people through their rulings in the Torah. All right, so in the first century, we've got to look at and understand who was in control, the different groups that there were out there, because there were different sects of Pharisees. There's the Sadducees, there's the Essenes, right? And we've got to understand these so that we can understand how authority was played out. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the rabbis and the priests. Now, when they came back from the Babylonian exile, there was a very small percentage of people of the Jews who actually came back from the exile. And they basically were to lack for priests. There were not a lot of priests. And even more so after the Maccabean, the Antiochus Epiphanes and the Maccabees, right? that a lot of the priests were slaughtered because they refused to sacrifice, pigs on the altar. They refused to eat unclean meat because that was their job. That was the role of the priest was to actually, discern between what is unclean and clean, what is holy and profane. And so after this, the Maccabean revolt and everything came back into order, now there was a big void because there just weren't a lot of priests to fill that void. And so a group rose up in Israel that became known as the rabbis. They split into basically two groups. There's the Sadducees and there's the Pharisees, right? And these were actually, kind of two different lines of thought. And by the time you get to the first century, most of the Sadducees or most of the priesthood actually were Sadducees. They were that was their belief. And one of their biggest beliefs, as you may know, is that they did not believe in the afterlife. And so since they did not believe in any sort of afterlife, no sort of resurrection, they were very into the here and now, into gaining wealth. And that's where we have, problems with Yeshua. He goes into the temple and he turns over the tables of the money exchangers. Why did he do that? Because the Sadducees were in control of the temple, right? And they were basically using it. They were manipulating the economy so that people would take, because they had to use the shekel, the Jerusalem shekel, in order to pay a tithe, right? So now they would change the exchange rates on these sort of things. And the same thing with the animals. Most people live too far to bring their own animals to the temple. So they would control all the production of livestock. And then you'd come to the temple, and during a feast day, when most people have to make a sacrifice, they jack the rates really high up. And so, they're basically robbing from the people. They're stealing from the people. And as a result of that, they became very wealthy group of people. Now, the rabbis, who were mainly the Pharisees, they actually became a very prestigious group themselves, not through monetary means, but through seizing power, right? They claimed control of the seat of Moshe, which was basically the Sanhedrin Council, right? The ruling body in Israel that basically, because today we try to separate church and state, right? Well, back then, in Judean culture, there was no such thing as that, right? The rabbinical court decreed on both halakha, on religious walk type matters, and on civil matters as well. And so these Pharisees had seized control of the Sanhedrin, and they were basically the court system in that day. So let's say that you wanted to go and get a divorce. You wouldn't go down to the local courthouse. What you would do is you would find three rabbis, and that would form a rabbinic court, and then you would present your case. Now, I don't know, I haven't found too much evidence to the contrary of this in the ancient Near East, but for sure, in the first century, the judicial proceedings were only done by a male, right? A female had no say in court. She could not come in and pursue any sort of legal matter. She had to have some male representing her. So what would happen, let's say, a husband was being extremely abusive to his wife and this wife wants a divorce. What does she do? Well, she goes to the court and she presents her case, and if the rabbis believe it, they need the male for the actual legal proceedings. And so what they would do is they would go and they would encourage the man to go ahead and divorce her. And how would they do that? Well, they would impose monetary fines, or they would actually beat the guy until he basically submitted to their court ruling, and then force him to sign the papers and to push for it to get that divorce, or the what we'll call a get. That's the divorce document. And we know that Yeshua talked about this seat of Moshe, and we'll talk about that for a minute here. What was the seat of Moshe? A lot of people have gone in and they've looked at Shem Tov's Hebrew Matthew and they say, well, it says, therefore do what he says, speaking of Moshe, and not don't do what the Pharisees do. Well, the problem with that is that Shem Tov's Hebrew Matthew is not at all a reliable source. It's full of handwritten notes. It's just it we don't know, we really can't verify its validity. So how else can we solve this dilemma? Because a lot of people see that and they go, oh, well, maybe we should actually be listening to the rabbis. That's not the context of what Yeshua is saying. What Yeshua is saying is, they sit in the seat of Moses, therefore do what they, you have to do what they say, but do not do as they do. You have to do what they say, because that seat of Moses was essentially the rabbinic court, right? They were the law. They were the government in Judea at the time. So what Yeshua was saying was, you know, if they make a decree, you have to follow it. Otherwise, you're going to be breaking the law of the land. But do not do as they do, because they are hypocrites, right? So you don't become disciples of these Pharisees. But you have to, in that time, day and time, you had to listen to them because they are the civil authority. Just like today in America, you know, there's nothing in the Torah that says I can't speed, right? So why can't I drive 100 miles an hour down the road? Well, because there's a civil authority, and God puts that civil authority there, you know, either for our good or for our, you know, to correct us. And so we have to actually obey those authorities. And so that's what Yeshua was talking about, was simply obeying the civil authority at the time. So, you know, in that time, we had the Pharisees. And there was actually seven different types of Pharisees. But in the first century, the biggest concern was actually there's two houses. There was the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. And these houses sprung up a couple, I think about 100 years before Yeshua. And for the most part, they disagreed on everything, right? You know, the house of Hillel would come out with a ruling, and house of Shammai would rule, oh, no, we're going to rule something different. We'll see some really good examples of this here in a couple minutes. But if you have not heard about this controversy, I would highly recommend going and checking out Rico Cortez has a teaching called The House of Hillel and the House of Shammai. And it really does he does a great job, you know, explaining all of the controversy and stuff and letting us see correctly what Yeshua was talking about a lot of times. So we have these two houses, right? In that time, the House of Shammai actually controlled the Sanhedrin, and therefore most of their rulings actually controlled the laws. But, you know, it depended if, you know, who you went to. You could go to a rabbinical court that made up of Pharisees from the house of Hillel, and you could get their rulings. Or you could go to a Sadducee, house of Shammai court and get rulings according to them. And a lot of times they would actually honor each other's rulings. But, you know, let's say they couldn't agree on something or there was a larger matter, then you would take it up. It was just like today, right? If a local court doesn't agree, they kick it up the level and they kick it up a level until you finally get to the Supreme Court. Well, in that day and time, the Supreme Court would have been the Sanhedrin Council, or even actually probably even higher. You know, Supreme Court really would have been a Roman court, which is where we see Yeshua being tried at, because that's where the death penalty was allowed. They were actually not allowed to carry out the death penalty on their own. So we have the Pharisees, we have the Sadducees, like I just talked about. They were a very wealthy group, and they controlled the temple. Now, unfortunately, we really don't have a lot of information about them, because basically history is written by the victors, and most of the Sadducees were completely wiped out. And so we really don't have a lot of records of, you know, of their beliefs and everything. We're mainly looking at stuff that's written by the Pharisees, who after the fall of Jerusalem, they kind of combined, you know, the House of Hillel and House of Shammai put aside their differences and kind of combined, with the House of Hillel mainly winning out, but there were some stuff that kind of traveled on from the Shammaians as well. But we just don't know a lot about the Sadducees. And then the third group is the Essenes. The Essenes lived out in the Qumran community, and they were a group of people who basically, they were apocalyptics, right? They believed that they were in the end times. They believed that the temple system was corrupt. So they had removed themselves from society, from the temple system, and tried to live out a holy life. They actually were trying to restore living back to the ancient Near Eastern time frame. They were, you know, if you really look at them, they actually are very similar. We're very similar in mindset to the Hebrew Roots movement of today. You know, this idea of restoration back to the original context of everything. And you know, it wasn't their time. We know historically they were completely wiped out, and we're just now going in and be able to find a lot of their documents, which has really helped us understand the culture at the first century. All right, so now we're going to look into the culture and the customs in the time of the first century. And in order to do that, we are going to need to use certain resources to understand this. We're going to have to look into the Mishnah. Now, some people will have some problems with the Mishnah because of you know, it was written by the Judaism, and it's used within modern Judaism today as a supplement and overtime, oftentimes overriding the scriptures. I do not put any authority in the Mishnah. However, in order to understand the culture at the time, we have to use certain historical documents, and the Mishnah is an excellent source of history as to what the laws of the time were. Because remember what we just talked about is that in in the first century, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they were both religious authority and a civil authority. So in order to understand the civil laws at the time in Judea, we have to look into the Mishnah in order to understand you know, just how people understood marriage, what was allowed, what was not allowed. How would you legally go about taking care of any problems with infidelity, divorce, remarriage, any of that stuff, right? So I am going to use the Mishnah here, and we're going to start off by reading several different tractates of it. But just remember, I'm not putting my authority here. I'm simply stating this is the civil law that was around at the time. Just like today, right? We have certain laws in this country that we have to follow regarding marriage because that's the legal court, right? You know, Yeshua said that you should not ever divorce someone other than matters of infidelity. Well, in America today, we can't follow that because our courts allow for multiple reasons for divorce. So I just want to make it very clear, I am not putting any authority here in the Mishnah. I'm simply using it as a resource. So to start off with, we are going to read Mishnah Ketubot 7.6. And this reads, "These are to be the divorced without receiving their ketubah." Remember, a ketubah was the dowry, essentially. The father would give of the bride would give this money to his daughter when she's getting married. So these are to be divorced without receiving their ketubah. A wife who transgresses the law of Moses, or one who transgresses Jewish practice. And what is regarded as a wife transgressing against the law of Moses? Feeding her husband untithed food, having intercourse with him during the period of her menstruation, not setting apart her dough offering, or making vows and not fulfilling them. So these right here are basically a set of rulings in Mishnah Ketubot 7, which state the reasons why a woman may legally be divorced without receiving that dowry that was paid to her by her father for instances where she's unrighteously divorced or if her husband was to die. So she would basically be divorced and be, thrown out with no way of supporting herself if she were to violate what these are the perceived laws in the Torah of Moses, right? Not the oral Torah, because remember there was two Torahs in the first century. There was the Torah of Moses, the written Torah, but then they also had the oral Torah, which is recorded in the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Talmud. All that stuff is a compilation of these laws that they had come up with. And so the next part of that same tractate. And what is deemed to be a wife's transgression against Jewish practices, the oral Torah, right? Going out with an uncovered head, spinning in the street, or conversing with every man. Abba Saul says, such transgressions include also that a wife who curses her husband's parents in her presence. Rabbi Tarfon says, also one who screams. And who is regarded as a screamer? A woman whose voice can be heard by her neighbors when she speaks inside her house. So basically, what this is saying is that according to the oral tradition, you could be divorced and lose your dowry if you went out in, as a woman. If a woman went out in public with her head uncovered, she could have her dowry, her entire way of supporting herself, taken away during the divorce. Also, you know, if she's spinning in the street, basically conversing with every man, basically all these things are considered suspected adultery. And if she suspected adultery, it's as if she committed adultery. Now, really quick, because, you know, there's within the Messianic movement, I know there is some discussion on should women wear head coverings, should they not? There is no law in the Torah, in the written Torah, that states a woman must wear her a head covering. This was a tradition in the time of the first century. And that's what was being addressed by Paul. And that's what's being addressed here in the Mishnah, is that according to the Mishnah, if a woman transgressed this cultural tradition, she was considered to have already committed adultery. And therefore, she would lose her ketubah, her dowry. She would have no way of supporting herself. So let's say she wasn't caught out in public, you know, speaking to another man or what, for whatever reason. And let's say that her husband suspected her of adultery. What would he do? Well, according to the Torah, right, you would come and you would do the trial by waters. In the Torah, it talks about you bring your wife to the temple. She's stripped bare. And then, you know, curse is written on a jar. They put it in there. And she drinks it, and basically, if she's found guilty, then her belly will swell and her thigh will rot, which means she would not be able to reproduce any more children after that. And we might get into that a little bit later, but basically what that was similar to the river ordeal. It was basically putting the judgment on whether this person was guilty or not in the hand of God and letting him be the deciding factor. So let's read what the Mishnah says concerning about this. And remember, this is the law of the land in the first century. This is simply the rabbinic or the Pharisaic and Sadducean definitions of the law and how this would actually be played out in the first century. So this is from Mishnah Sotah 1. And if you want to look this stuff up, there's a great resource online. It's called www.rabbinictraditions.com. It's a website put together by David and Stone Brewer where you can see the Mishnah, the Tosefta, and the Talmuds, the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud. And they're all kind of laid out so you can see the corresponding things. And it's a free website, but if you pay, you can get some extra features. But anyway, so this is where I'm getting the translation of the Mishnah from. So this is Mishnah Sotah 1.1 through 1.7 here. If one warns his wife not to associate with a certain man, Rabbi Eliezer says, he warns her on the testimony of two witnesses and makes her drink the water of bitterness, on the testimony of one witness or his personal testimony. Rabbi Joshua says, he warns her on the testimony of two and makes her drink on the testimony of two. Right, so there's a little bit of disagreement there on how many witnesses were required prior to actually making her undergo the trial by bitter waters. How does he warn her? If he says to her in the presence of two, do not converse with that man, and she conversed with him, she is still permitted to her husband in a sexual manner and permitted to partake of the heave offering. Should she have entered into a private place with him and stayed with him a time sufficient for misconduct to have occurred, she is forbidden to her husband and forbidden to partake of the heave offering. Right? She's basically prohibited from coming into the temple in fear that her transgression will defile the temple as well. If her husband died, she performs the ceremony of halizah, which is the shoe removing, right? And they spit in their face, and cannot contract a levirate marriage. So she's not allowed to marry her dead husband's brother if she was suspected of adultery prior to his death. The following are prohibited to partake of the heave offering. She who says, "I am unclean to thee," when witnesses came and testified that she had misconducted herself. She who says, "I refuse to drink the water," when the husband is willing to take to make her drink, when the husband or is unwilling to make her drink, and when the husband cohabited with her on her journey. Right, these are the reasons why she would not be allowed to come into the temple and partake of the heave offering to perform the sacrifice. Right. How does her husband deal with her? He brings her to the court of justice in the place where he resides, and they assign him two disciples of the sages, lest he cohabit with her on the journey. Rabbi Judah says her husband is trusted with her. So there's a little bit of difference. When they're traveling to Jerusalem to perform this trial by bitter waters, is she allowed to actually travel with her husband? Because the fear is maybe that he might, sleep with her, and thus if he does that after she's been while she's been accused, then we run into all sorts of problems. They bring her up to the great court of justice, which is in Jerusalem, and the judges solemnly charge her in the same way they charge witnesses in capital cases, and say to her, "My daughter, wine does much, frivolity does much, youth does much, bad neighbors do much. Do it for the sake of his great name, which is written in holiness, so that it may not be obliterated by the water." And they relate to her the matters which neither she nor her family of her father's house is worthy to hear. All right, so this is how they legally go about charging her for suspected adultery. If she says, "I have misconducted myself," she gives a quittance for her marriage settlement, her ketubah, or her dowry, and departs. But if she says, "I am pure," they bring her to the east gate, which is by the entrance to the Nicanor gate, where they give the suspected woman the water to drink, purifying the women after childbirth and purifying lepers. The priest seizes her garments. If they are rent, they are rent. If they become unstitched, they are become unstitched until he uncovers her bosom and undoes her hair. Now, Rabbi Judah says, if her bosom was beautiful, he does not uncover it. And if her hair is beautiful, he does not undo it. Right? So Rabbi Judah is basically saying, well, if she's a beautiful woman, we need to violate God's commandments in order to keep her covered up. When the Torah says that you're to bare her breasts. Which is a sign of adultery, right? Whenever an adulterous woman would be sent forth, they would strip her naked, strip her of her garments, which shows a stripping off of that dowry. Now, some people may misunderstand this a little bit. If she says, "I have misconducted myself," she gives acquittance of her marriage settlement and departs, right? Well, the Torah, what does the Torah say about adultery? The Torah says that you should stone the adulterer and the adulteress. Well, we've got two problems here. Number one, this is the woman by herself. We have no indication that they know who she was to have slept with. And say she, they did know, they still would have had to have two witnesses of the act in accordance with the Torah in order to carry out the death penalty, right? You don't just stone people who you suspect of adultery. It has to be proven in a court of law. And then, of course, the second problem is that in the first century, the Romans had removed the Jewish right of carrying out capital punishment cases. They were not allowed to carry out the death penalty. So 1.6, if she is clothed in white, he clothes her in black. If she has worn golden ornaments and necklaces, earrings, finger rings, they remove them from her in order to make her repulsive. After that, the priest takes a common rope and binds it over her breasts. Whoever wishes to look upon her comes to look, with the exception of her male and female slaves, because her heart is made defiant through them. All women are permitted to look on her, as it is said, that all women may be taught not to do after your lewdness, right? So she's made a public spectacle, much like her husband was made a public mockery by her going into the bed of another man. She's made a public spectacle. However, they don't want her slaves to look on her because they might now feel that they are in a higher position than her. And remember, she's not yet proven to have been committed adultery yet. In the measure with which a man measures is meted out to him. She adorned herself for transgression. The Holy One, blessed be He, made her repulsive. She exposed herself for a transgression. The Holy One, blessed be He, held her up for exposure. She began the transgression with the thigh and afterwards with the womb. Therefore, she is punished first with the thigh and afterwards in the womb, nor does all the body escape. Right? So right there, they're midrashing on why the thigh rots and the belly swells is because that's the manner in which she committed that adultery. All right, so in Mishnah Sotah 6, this is where we have recorded the reasons why a man can actually go ahead and accuse her of adultery and bring his wife before the priests in order to determine if she's guilty through the trial of bitter waters. Mishnah Sotah 6.1 through 6.4 is what I'll be reading here. If a man warned his wife and she secluded herself with another man, even if he heard what she had done so from a flying bird, he divorces her and gives her the marriage settlement. Such is the statement by Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. He does not do this until the woman who spin by moonlight discuss her. Right, so right there, this is saying if she secluded herself and he hears about it, then he doesn't even go through the trial by waters, which is what sotah means. It's talking about the trial by bitter waters. That's what the Hebrew word means. If one witness said, I saw that she committed misconduct, she does not drink the water. Not only that, but even a slave, male or female, who is believed also to disqualify her for the marriage settlement. Her mother-in-law, her father, or her mother-in-law's daughter, her associate wife, her sister-in-law, and her stepdaughter are believed not to disqualify her for the marriage settlement, but she should not drink. All right, so there's certain reasons why she could drink or not of the water. And if there's witnesses, and basically what this is saying, right, is if there's witnesses to the deed of misconduct, then she doesn't drink the waters. She is guilty of adultery, and therefore she loses her dowry, her ketubah, and is sent out of her house. And you got to remember, this isn't just losing the dowry. She now has a stigma on her that, unlike a woman who's divorced for any matter, just for any reason, this woman is now known as an adulteress, and she's probably not going to get remarried in the culture at the time. So moving on, it is proper conclusion that if the first evidence that the woman had secluded herself with a man, which does not prohibit her to her husband for all time, is not established by fewer than two witnesses, it is not right that the final evidence that she had misconducted herself, which prohibits her to him for all time, should not be established by fewer than two witnesses. They understand, according to the Torah, you have to have two witnesses. Therefore, there is a text to state, there be no witnesses against her, i.e., whatever evidence there may be against her is believed, even if only by one witness. And with respect to the evidence about her seclusion with a man, that one witness suffices may be argued by a fortier reasoning as follows. If the evidence regarding the misconduct which prohibits her to her husband for all time is established by one witness, is it not proper that the first evidence which does not prohibit her to him for all time should be established by one witness? Therefore, There is a text to state, because he hath found some unseemly matter in her, and elsewhere it states, by the mouth of two witnesses, or by the mouth of three witnesses, shall a matter be established. As the matter mentioned in this latter case must be confirmed on the testimony of two witnesses, so also, here in the case of a suspected woman, the matter must be confirmed by the testimony of two witnesses. So basically what that whole little section was there, because I was talking about one witnesses, two witnesses, and if you didn't catch that, this is kind of like an internal discussion that's being recorded here, and they're giving the proof text that the Torah says that a matter must be confirmed by two or three witnesses, and therefore, since this is talking about in Deuteronomy 24, this is talking about a matter of indecency, this matter, therefore, must be confirmed by at least two witnesses. If one witness says she misconducted herself, and another witness says she did not, or if a woman says of her that she misconducted herself, and another woman says that she did not, she drinks the water, right? If one person says she did, and another person says she didn't, now there's that, we don't know for sure. She's now suspected, not confirmed, because two witnesses confirm, one witness leads to suspicion of adultery, and therefore the bitter water trial. If one witness says she misconducted herself, and two say that she did not, she drinks the water. If two say that she misconducted herself, and one says that she did not, she does not drink the water, and therefore, she would be guilty of that adultery, and therefore lose her ketubah. So, as you can see, in the first century, because they had been, their ability to perform the death penalty on cases that required a death penalty had been removed, they had to find another way to enforce the laws of adultery, right? If they had a murderer, they could send him to the Greco-Roman court system. But as we will find out later on, in the Greco-Roman court system, adultery was not considered a capital punishment. It simply led to the loss of any claim if that was spelled out in the marriage contract. So since they could not actually carry out the death penalty, they resorted to taking away the ketubah, or the dowry. And remember, we have a dowry, and then we have the bride price. And in the first century, the bride price was no longer actually paid to the father. It was simply, promised to the father by that husband. And if he misconducted himself and divorced her, he would end up actually owing that money to the bride's father. But the dowry was actually given to the couple, and it was put into the control of the husband. But it was understood that if he were to divorce her, or if he were to die, that money would go to her unless there was a divorce for valid grounds. So now, using this principle, what they would do in the first century is now they would use the dowry as a punishment. So let's say that a husband misconducts himself. Well, before they force him to divorce his wife, say he's beating her, right? Before they force him to divorce his wife, what they're going to do is they're going to actually take that dowry that was written down somewhere, and they're going to add to that ledger, right? Say he's supposed to pay her, the dowry was 200 shekels, right? Which, that's not what it was at the time, but we'll just use that as an example. And say he hits her, right? Well, what they're going to do now is the dowry is going to go up. Now the dowry is 250 shekels. So, and it's going to keep on going up and going up until he reaches the point where they're going to force him to divorce his wife, and then she's going to get this large sum of money. Now, likewise, if the wife was misconducting herself, the court system could deduct from that dowry until it was completely gone. So, they could start taking away, 10 shekels at a time, to the point where when he finally decides to divorce her, even if it's for an any matter divorce, which the any matter divorce meant that she would, he would divorce her, but she gets to keep the dowry. But if she's been misconducting herself and she's had her dowry reduced down from 200 shekels down to 10 shekels. Now he can divorce her for whatever reason, give her 10 shekels, and she's gone. And now he's kept all the rest of the dowry. So, you know, it was a very instrumental tool in helping with marital problems in the time. So what we're going to do is we're going to read over a couple tractates from Mishnah Ketubot. And Ketubot is, you know, the dowry. So we're going to read 5.5. The following are kinds of work which a woman must perform for her husband: grinding corn, baking bread, washing clothes, cooking, suckling her child, making his bed, and working in wool. If she bought him one bondswoman, she needs not to do the grinding or the baking or the washing. If she bought two bondswomen, she needs not do the cooking or the suckling of her child. If three, she neither needs to make ready his bed nor work in wool. If four, she may lounge in an easy chair. If they have four, she has four slaves, she can just lay around all day, is what they're saying here, right? Rabbi Eliezer, however, says, even if she bought him 100 bondswomen, he may compel her to work in wool, for idleness leads to unchastity. Right? So according to Rabbi Eliezer, if your wife's sitting around doing nothing all day, she's probably going to go out and commit adultery, so you better put her to work, is what he's saying here. Rabbi Shimon B. Gamliel said, even if a man forbade his wife under a vow to do any work, he must divorce her and give her a ketubah, to her, for idleness leads to idiocy, right? So, according to Rabbi Eliezer, a woman sitting around doing nothing leads to unchastity. According to this Rabbi Gamliel, it leads to her becoming stupid. So, you know, obviously these rabbis didn't really have a very high regard for women, which is kind of important for us to see, is how they viewed women, right? And this, remember, again, this is not scriptural. This is simply the mindset of those Pharisees that Yeshua oftentimes came against. And that's not to say he came against every Pharisee, because there were different Pharisees. But we can kind of see the mindset that he was coming up against. Mishnah Ketubah 5.6. This one is this one's really interesting. It actually kind of relates to Paul. Because you remember, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but Paul says, husbands, give your body to your wife, and wives, give your body to your husband. Right? Meaning, don't basically go celibate in your marriage. That you need to have intimacy in your marriage. So Paul says that you need to be done. Now listen to how the rabbis instead define this. If a man forbade himself by a vow to have intercourse with his wife, Beit Shammai, remember the house of Shammai versus the house of Hillel, ruled she must consent to the deprivation for 2 weeks. Rabbi Hillel ruled 1 week. Right, so Shammai says you can vow to be celibate for 2 weeks. Hillel says 1 week. Students may go away to study the Torah without the permission of their wives for a period of 30 days. What did Paul say? Paul said you are allowed to do this, you know, for a short period, but make sure you come back together. And he did not define the number of days. So that those are students who are allowed to do that. Laborers only for 1 week. So they Pharisees consider themselves to be students of the Torah. So they allowed themselves a 30-day period of celibacy, while they ruled that anybody else was only allowed 1 week to study. The times of conjugal duty prescribed in the Torah are for men of independence every day. Now that is actually really, really funny. When you study into the reason for this, the Pharisees themselves were not a very rich and affluential group of people. They were essentially kind of the poorer people of society. Not to say that they were the lower class, but they were probably around in the middle class. Now, the Sadducees, on the other hand, remember, they did not believe in a resurrection, and therefore they used their power and their influence in the temple to essentially rob the people. So these would have been men of independence who, because of their money, they didn't have to go out and work for a living. And so what the rabbis did is they ruled that this class of people, they're required to have conjugal duties every day. Otherwise, they can have their ketubah increased against them, right? So laborers must perform conjugal duty twice a week. For a donkey driver, once a week. For a camel driver, every 30 days. And for sailors, once in 6 months. These are the rulings of Rabbi Eliezer. So, it's kind of funny that they say, oh, you have to, perform your conjugal duties every 2 days, once a week, once every 6 months, right? Like it's an actual chore. That's essentially what they're bringing up to, is that it's a chore. But it's interesting when you contrast this with what Paul said. Paul just says, don't do it for a long time. He doesn't put, limits based on your occupation. So you can kind of see here that Paul was speaking to, you should desire this. That, he's not saying, I'm not going to put a limit on, how long you can do this, but just make sure that you're in mutual agreement and that you come back together for whatever reason and not have these problems. Whereas the rabbis, they had to quantify everything, right? It seems like when you look at all the rabbi stuff, it's all about quantification. You can only walk this many steps on Shabbat. Whereas Yeshua and the disciples seem to be the quality of everything. They're saying, don't walk too far. Don't do this. But they don't ever put they kind of leave it up. You know what your limits are. You know what turns a Sabbath walk into work. And so, therefore, do what you know is right. And, it comes down to a matter of, where is your heart? Are you trying to keep the commandments out of love, or are you just trying to put a limit on it so that you could? Because basically what happens when you have a limit, that means that as long as you fulfill that limit, you're good. And it's not being done out of a desire to actually keep that commandment, just as a desire to have that minimum there. All right, so the last one we have here is Mishnah Ketubot 5.7. Actually, it's not the last one. There's a couple more that we'll read here. If a wife rebels against her husband, her ketubah may be reduced by 7 denarii a week. Rabbi Judah says 7 tropakes. For how long may this reduction continue? Until a sum corresponding to her ketubah has been accumulated. All right, so she can have her ketubah reduced by 7 denarii each week, until she has essentially no more money in her ketubah, and then she would be divorced. Rabbi Jose said, reductions may be continually until such a time when, should the inheritance fall to her from elsewhere, her husband will be in position to collect from her the full amount due. So same thing, basically. Similarly, if a husband rebels against his wife, an addition of 3 denarii a week is made to her ketubah. Rabbi Judah says 3 tropakes. So you can kind of see right there a very unfair balance. If the wife rebels, she gets reduced by 7 denarii. But if the husband rebels, he only adds 3 denarii. So definitely some inequality in those measures being used there. Let's go on to Mishnah Ketubot 6.1. A wife's find and her handiwork belong to her husband, and of her inheritance, he has the usufruct during her lifetime. Any compensation and indignity or blemish which is afflicted upon her belongs to her. Rabbi Judah ruled that in privacy she receives 2/3 compensation while he receives 1/3. But in public, he receives 2/3 and she receives 1/3. His share is to be given to him forthwith, but hers land is to be bought and he enjoys the usufruct. Right? So basically, if a woman works, or if a woman were just to like say you your wife finds $100. Well, if she finds $100 in private, $66 of that would go to her, which would actually, I mean, would go to her ketubah, even though that money would actually go to, all the money would actually go to her husband, but $66 would go to the, to add addition onto the ketubah. Whereas, if she works and she earns $100, in public, right, now only 33 of those dollars are added onto her ketubah, and the rest just goes to her husband. So once again, a very unequal weight cast against the woman there, that, you know, she just, her worth isn't really balanced out against the worth of her husband. What her works, basically, a lot of the money would actually go to her husband if she were to perform any work. You know, and the last thing I wanted to point out here in the first century Judean culture is that there was no stigma against a divorced or a woman or a widowed woman unless they had been had committed adultery. If you if a woman was divorced for any reason, then you know, there people it wasn't like people didn't want to marry her anymore, or if her husband died, you know, she was equally a prospective bride as compared to anyone else. And in fact, she might actually be a little bit higher sought after, because the one thing is that her bride price that the husband would have to promise would be reduced to say it would be significantly lower, approximately one mene, which is about 100 shekels, whereas if she was had was a virgin, it would be 200 zuz, which is essentially a couple thousand shekels, right? So I mean, we're talking like her bride price is like 10%. So a lot of times, these divorced or widowed women would actually be very sought after as a second wife now because of that reduced bride price. He wouldn't have to promise as much, and therefore would have less liability if something were to happen. And these women, not only were was this going on, but they're also encouraged to get remarried if they never had children, because remember, it was considered a commandment in the first century to actually be fruitful and multiply. Remember in Genesis, it says, God says, be fruitful and multiply. And so that was actually considered their very first commandment, was that you shall have children, right? And so if a woman or a man divorced and they didn't have children, they would be highly encouraged to go out and remarry. And in fact, if a woman and man got married after 10 years, if they did not have any children, they would be basically kind of forced by the courts to divorce in order to marry other people in hopes that then they would be able to reproduce children. All right, so we're gonna take a break here in the video and come back for part two.